Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
A mid-morning dance with the devil from the Farmer of Fury.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's all kicking off this morning in the fictional land of Brexit. Jacob Rees-Mogg is busy calling Mark Carney a failed second-rate Canadian politician after he and his cronies at the Bank of England predicted all sorts of Armageddon in the event of a no-deal Brexit. The dire warnings of house price slumps and market crashes have been dismissed as project hysteria, and they probably are. Meanwhile, Theresa May is in front of a committee in the House of Commons in which she's explaining why she believes that her deal is the best deal that you can get. Are we going to have to listen to this nonsense for about another month or two or three, maybe? Meanwhile, back in the real world, Matt Hancock has finally had a good idea. The health secretary has worked out that it's time for the NHS to be more like McDonald's. Just imagine if they were running a fast food empire. No one would get fed and a Big Mac would cost about £1 million. But in all seriousness, there is a lot to learn from the American hamburger chain. First off, they could treat us all as customers instead of victims. They could utilise technology in the accident and emergency department properly, and they could streamline all their outpatient services and make them more like the takeaway business. Now, I'm sure you've got some great ideas as to what you could do to improve the NHS, and we want to hear them. 0344 499 1000. Coming up later on, we'll tell you where the best place to live in Britain is, and the results may surprise you. And we'll find out how Alexa might soon be predicting just how long your relationship will last, and why Mead is making a comeback as well. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Lots more to talk about, including the police coming up in a little while, because it turns out we were talking about the police earlier on this week and how ridiculous it is that they're having to waste so much of their time dealing with people who are suffering mental health issues, mental health problems. And we found out that all but five people have made so many thousands of telephone calls just to one particular police station, which is mad in the first place. But it now turns out that in the Metropolitan Police in London, Britain's biggest police force, only about one third of all crime reports get completely and utterly dismissed after one telephone call with the victim. We'll talk about that and why. Apparently, if you're a shoplifter, you'll get away with it, basically, as long as you only shoplift about 50 quid's worth of stuff or less, which seems a little bit unfortunate as well, doesn't it? 0344 499 1000 is the number we want you to call us on this morning, though, because we're going to talk, first of all, about the NHS, and we're going to start things off with Dr. Louise Irvine, South London GP. She's from the National Health Action Party, because Matt Hancock, who's a relatively newly installed health secretary, has not exactly set the heather on fire with any of his great ideas. But today we are told that he believes it's time perhaps for the NHS to learn something from McDonald's, the big American burger conglomerate. He thinks that if the NHS was more like McDonald's, where the people who work there apparently are very happy, then he would be very happy as well. Let's find out if Dr. Louise Irvine agrees. Hello, Dr. Louise. A very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. I mean, is Matt Hancock right here, or has he kind of gone slightly off piste, as it were?
Oh, Matt Hancock, I mean, he's got a problem because he's going to be facing an even worse winter crisis in the NHS this winter.
Right.
And he has to come up with some sound bites and things to sound like he's got some ideas. So he comes up with these ridiculous notions which actually don't address the real problems facing the NHS.
Right. What do you think he means, though, when he says this? Because, I mean, he's not a stupid man. He must have some clue as to what he's likely to get as a reaction for saying something like this. I mean, I suppose what I'm imagining what he means is that McDonald's is a very well-run, sort of a very efficient organisation where everybody knows when they walk in the door what they're going to get.
Well, when I read the article, he actually was talking about McDonald's leadership training. Apparently,
yeah,
they fast-track their staff into management positions. And he said that the NHS needs more leaders. Now, I think, so that was the main point he was making. I think there are two issues here. One is that his government has absolutely cut the funding for medical and nursing and all other allied health professional training. So, in fact, we don't have enough doctors and nurses and others to actually provide care for patients.
Right. I mean, it seems to be wasting an awful lot of money on agency nurses who come in because there aren't enough nurses to staff the thing in the first place. You know, I mean, maybe he ought to take a bit of advice from McDonald's himself and get some leadership in government.
Well, yeah, the other thing about the NHS is it spends millions and millions on consultancies from organisations like PricewaterhouseCooper, McKinsey's, etc.
Right.
So, who are providing supposedly some kind of leadership, which I think is actually very damaging and very wasteful of resources. So I think there is an issue about looking at how the NHS is led, and I think that nurses, doctors and other staff should have a greater role in saying how things are to be done, and I agree with that.
Mm.
But to do that, we actually need to have enough doctors, nurses, etc. We've got over 100,000 vacancies in the NHS.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why the experience for many patients has deteriorated, because, you know, the A&Es are overwhelmed. GP practices, like, we cannot give appointments to people in time because we don't have enough doctors and nurses, even in our practice.
Mm. Yes, I'd like to ask you about that, if I may, because you're a GP in a busy part of the world. I imagine South London's been pretty overcrowded with people. I mean, what is the problem with GP surgeries at the moment? Because we hear sort of differing stories of complaints from patients who say they can't get an appointment until next week or from 2 weeks from now, unless something really ill has gone wrong and they have to go to an A&E. Is it just the fact that you've got too many patients signed up, not enough doctors? Which is it?
Yes, it's very hard to... Very few GPs. There are fewer GPs per person than there were in 2010.
Mm.
So we've lost GPs, and our practice is, I don't want to talk about my practice particularly, but just as an example, is by all standards a good practice, and yet we were unable to recruit a new doctor, although we advertised for months.
Right.
It's very, other practices, there's been vacancies in London, in South East London where I work. There are practices, good practices, with advertising for the last year for replacement doctors. We can't get the doctors, and it's very hard even to get practice nurses.
And what do you think the reason is you can't find somebody to fill that post in your particular surgery?
I think that general practice is perceived now by many young doctors as being a hugely... the workload is... massive.
Right.
People work much longer than their paid hours. They're still here till 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, finishing off, looking at the reports, looking at results, writing the referral letters. And it's become quite ironically, the more understaffed you are, the workload is still there. So that has to be shared up amongst the remaining staff who have even more to do. So I regularly go in at the weekend when it's quiet and just get on with my admin work.
Just with admin work, because you must not have time really to do that. Because we often also hear complaints from people whenever they call in to this show anyway, that, you know, when they do see a doctor, it's only usually for 3 or 4 minutes at a time. They very rarely get an awful lot of time to talk about anything.
Many of the doctors in my practice, we give the patients as much time as they need, and that's why we often run late. Of course, people complain about that, but we do give, and we have a lot of people with mental health problems, and sometimes they need, you know, 20, 30 minutes to talk about things. So we do try, but that's another reason why I think we always run late. I think the thing is, there's a huge amount of need and a huge amount of good that we can be doing for people, but we do need the resources to be able to do that, whether it's in primary care, whether it's in hospitals, whether it's in mental health care. And I think that it's ultimately the responsibility of the Secretary of State for Health to have an overview of what's really happening in the NHS, why we are all struggling, staff are struggling so much to provide a good service for patients. And it boils down to being grossly understaffed. It is also underfunded. We're spending less on the health service now per person than we were last year and the year before. And all the promises of future funding are only going to make up for something like £13 billion of deficits that the hospitals have and other things. It's very unlikely.
But we do throw an awful lot of money, don't we, at the NHS? And I'm afraid to say that I have often said on this show that money doesn't necessarily hold the key and the answer to everything, because we do put an awful lot of money in and we don't get much back out in terms of efficiency.
Well, I mean, a GP practice gets paid something like £120 per year per person on our list, and that is to provide all care from cradle to grave, preventative care and acute care and all kinds of other things. So I think if you compare how much we spend on health in the UK compared with other Western European countries, we spend far less per person on health care. So, you know, you're talking about huge, you know, 60 million people that have to have health care of all kinds. Of course it's expensive, but we're not spending more, we're spending less than comparable economies. Yes, it could be more efficient, and I go back to all the money that's wasted on management consultants and the kind of what I would call the costs, the transaction costs of the market, all the bidding and tendering and all that stuff that's going on, which is extremely wasteful. I think the money needs to go to frontline care. It needs to go to increasing the staffing numbers because it's dire in many hospitals now. There are huge rota gaps with one junior doctor covering two junior doctors' work. It's really hard for some
so
of the
how,
nurses.
How would you as a doctor advise Mr. Matt Hancock to improve the recruitment process? How would you get more doctors in in the short term?
He needs to increase funding for the NHS, real terms funding. He needs to actually look at the workload and the working conditions and the unsafe working conditions for many doctors and nurses and other staff, where they're running, they're just on their knees sometimes, just desperate and unable to even think sometimes. So he needs to actually make sure,
make it a more attractive proposition, in other words.
Make it more attractive. Listen to them, find out what the issues are, look for remedies, increase the funding, increase recruitment, make it once again the fantastic job it is. It's a fantastic job being a doctor or being a nurse, being working in the caring professions. But if it's become untenable, if people are leaving because they just cannot carry on coping with the stresses of the work. So you've got to address the work stress really, really seriously and make it the job that people really want to do, because there's so much dedication in the NHS and it is so fantastic and what it can do, but it's really struggling now.
Okay.
And it's his job to actually deal with that and not come up with stupid sound bites.
Okay, well, stupid sound bites, of course, is what the government does. Dr. Louise Irvine, thank you very much indeed. She says that Matt Hancock needs to stop with the stupid sound bites, needs to come up with some better ideas than saying, for example, the NHS should be more like McDonald's. But we're going to talk now, though, to Professor Sir Robert Lechler. He's the president of the Academy of Medical Sciences, because they've also put out a report today calling for a culture change in the NHS, saying that health data and medical technology communities should be improved, and we should ensure that the NHS now benefits from new technology. Professor Sir Robert, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. I don't know if you were able to listen to Dr. Irvine there. She was basically calling for more money and a change in the kind of working practices inside the NHS. Is she right?
Of course she's right. So I think none of us would want to deflect attention from some of the pressing needs in the NHS, which include continuing to put in more resource for frontline services and all that. I think everybody would agree about that, and I suspect that the Secretary of State would probably also agree about that. And I don't think that these comments about McDonald's should or were intended, I would hope, to deflect attention from that need.
I don't think they were, and I think he has a point in the sense that, you know, I know he was referring specifically to their kind of leadership debates and their leadership challenges and all of that. But however, I mean, if we were all treated much more like customers by the NHS, I think people would be happier with that.
Well, I think the point, I mean, nor are we debating whether McDonald's is good for the nation's health, because that would be a totally different topic.
Well, that would be, and some people have pointed out that was perhaps not the greatest example of the company that he could have used.
A questionable choice. But I think, the point he was making was one about leadership and investing in training people in leadership. And that, with that, I agree. I mean, I think I'd cut him some slack on that particular point. And the reason that I think it's so important is that if you can be sure of one thing looking ahead, it is that healthcare and the way we deliver it and the technologies that support it and the diagnostics that are available to us and the treatments that are coming down the line are all going to change a lot. And so if we're going to need to adapt, then what adapting needs is strong and effective and skilled leadership. So I think that the need for leadership is absolutely spot on. And I suspect, I don't know a huge amount about McDonald's, but maybe they do invest well in their staff. And that's something that, of course, we'd be well advised to do.
Well, whenever you walk into a McDonald's, and I don't do it very often for the same reason that most people don't do it very often if they can help it, the bottom line is that everybody is doing a job, everybody seems to know what their job is, and everybody seems relatively happy doing it. Now, you don't always see that when you walk into a hospital or indeed when you walk into a doctor's surgery.
I think that's a fair comment. And staff satisfaction and having a happy staff is really, really important to patient care because there's a correlation between clinical outcomes and how satisfied and happy your staff are. So, but that's, we're straying back to the, you know, investment and frontline services topic if we're not careful, because that is, I'm not deflecting attention to that. It's absolutely vital. I'm coming back to the leadership point. And if you just allow me to mention that the Academy, of which I'm a president, is just launching a new leadership program that we're quite excited about that is designed to train people to lead not only within the NHS but across sectors, so with a crossing industry, NHS and universities. And I think that is the kind of leadership that we need, that's really adaptable, that's really flexible, that understands different sectors and can move the NHS forward into ways that will allow it really to adopt the technology that the Secretary of State is very enthusiastic about and a real champion of, and make sure that that is deployed to deliver better patient care.
So sure.
I'm going to sort of support his point about investing in leadership, because I think it's going to be so essential.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this show's only 3 hours long, so we haven't got enough time to actually debate all the things that could be better in the NHS. And I'm not bashing it here, but I'm just saying that, I do worry sometimes when people call for more investment and more money, that it's all just going into some big black hole, and it's not being terribly well managed, and it's different depending on which part of the country you're in. It's different depending on what time of the day it is. You know, I mean, there are so many variables that surely we need to somehow think about using technology to actually sort of smooth things out, if you like, to make things more consistent in the whole of the country instead of in parts of it.
Yeah, well, of course, you're right. So, you know, the postcode lottery, so-called, is indefensible.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of work going on to try to standardise practices. And the elements of the NHS that I have direct dealings with, which are three leading foundation trusts in central and southeast London, I can assure you they're very well managed, very well led, and working really hard to do exactly one of the points you were making about really good customer service management. So, you know, you're quite right. When you turn up to a GP surgery or an outpatient clinic, someone should say, good morning, how are you? I'm very glad you're here.
Yeah.
I think all that stuff, it really does matter. But alongside that, we need to make sure that the levels of investment are sufficient. And as you rightly say, that technology is being used to make the service the most efficient possible.
No, indeed.
We're on the same page there. I was just going to say that there are still some slightly outdated practices in how paper dependent sometimes some elements of the service are. There should be electronic records that means wherever you pitch up, in the country, in fact, someone could rapidly access your data and find out what they need to know about you without having to dig up pieces of paper or get paper records.
No, indeed. Professor, thanks very much indeed. Professor Sir Robert Lechler there, President of the Academy of Medical Sciences, with some ideas for how to make the NHS better. You'll have plenty of those ideas as well. Harry's granddad says this on Twitter: Mike, I'm at a loss to see how the doctor blames HM government for recruitment. Surely that is the responsibility of NHS management. HM government are not recruiters. Clearly there is the money, as there are vacancies for which they have the budget. So it's all about the NHS management. I think you're absolutely right to say that. There's absolutely no reason to blame the government, because the government are putting loads and loads of money in and getting very, very little out in return.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Human Zoo, where they don't hide away the sick animals.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On Talk Radio.
This is is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. You know what to do. Here's the number, 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we're going to be speaking about why millions of millennials are going to swap the tinsels and the Father Christmas figures and the trees for unicorns and mermaids, as they're going to give a festive makeover to Christmas so that it doesn't offend anybody. I mean, for heaven's sake, please give me strength. A couple of tweets for you. Scott says, tell that bloke on the phone it would be a referendum or this on this deal plus civil war as the three choices. Well, that bloke on the phone was in fact John Rentall, the chief political commentator for The Independent, not just any bloke on the phone. Let's go to Scunthorpe and talk to Samantha. Hello, Samantha.
Yeah, morning.
Morning. What would you like to tell us?
Yeah, on the subject of the NHS
yes.
and recruitment and your difficulty in recruiting, you know, now they, when I did my training back in the early 90s, you got a bursary.
Right.
Obviously, before that, you actually, you know, worked at the hospital, didn't you? So in both cases, you were paid.
Right.
But now they have to go to university. Well, I know when I did my training, there was a lot of mature students who wouldn't have been there but for the fact that they were receiving some sort of wage.
Sure.
I'm sure that must make a difference to, you know, people wanting to go into nurse training, really. So
I think also a lot of them have got wise, Samantha, some of the nurses anyway, as we heard from our friend whose wife runs a doctor's surgery. You know, a lot of doctors have worked out that they don't have to go into business to be a doctor. They can just be a locum. They can work when they want, where they want. Same way as a nurse can now join an agency, probably make more money and actually just work when they want to work.
Yeah, well, that's true. But then you don't get holiday. You don't get holiday pay. I mean, you don't get you know, your pension. And the other thing is, you never know where you're going to end up. And
well, true.
As an agency nurse, you can be sort of used as the, you know, we'll give that patient today to her because she's not normally here and they're a bit hard work, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure. So. No, absolutely right. No, it's a terrible mess. But what do you make of the whole McDonald's analogy? Do you think that there's something in that they could be a bit more kind of user-friendly?
Yeah, well, I think that, I don't know about that, but I do think that, you know, as well as money being paid through national insurance, perhaps we do need to look at adding money in, you know, some sort of policy. I mean, they do that, don't they, in Europe?
Yeah, they do, They do, but I'm wary of just throwing...
But I also think that money needs spending more sensibly, and when you have big organisations, you always get waste.
Yes. No, that's very true. And that goes for private organisations as well. Samantha, thanks very much indeed for your thoughts. Thanks very much indeed for your call. You can join in the debate, of course. This is after Matt Hancock, the health secretary, came out and said that he thinks that the NHS should be run more like McDonald's. Now, he was being quite specific about the leadership aspects of all of that. But equally, I want to hear from you. You know, what could the NHS do that the McDonald's does very, very well indeed? I was making the point earlier that if the NHS actually ran McDonald's, you'd probably never get a Big Mac. You'd have to wait about 4 years for it, and it would cost about £1 million. 0344 499 1000. Now, we've been talking about a lot of different things this week on this show, not least, of course, whether or not certain parts of this country are better than certain other parts of this country. There's a new story out today, in fact, which tells you precisely where the best place to live in this country is. And guess what? It is in Lee-on-Sea in Essex, and we've got Councillor Carol Mulroney to tell us why. Councillor, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for speaking to me. Not at all. Thanks very much for coming on. Lee-on-Sea, the best place to live in Britain. Apparently the happiest place to live, the most picturesque. I mean, you know, the list of compliments goes on and on.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's nice to hear, and it's nice to see it being celebrated because we all celebrate it here.
Absolutely right. Now, tell us what the great highlights of Lee-on-Sea are, because I'm sorry to admit, I don't think I've ever been there.
Well, shame on you.
I know, I'm terribly sorry. I sort of go south for the weekend rather than east, so I'll have to head out that way at some point.
Yeah, well, Lee-on-Sea is quite a smallish community, but it has a huge community spirit. There are no end of organisations, clubs and things that people can get involved in. I think we are good because we have a whole range of ages. We've got quite an elderly population, but we've also got a very young population as well.
Right.
And all the spectrum in between. But we've got so much going for us in terms of we're on the water side, which everybody wants to live by the sea.
Mm.
We've got a historic old town. Heritage is my big thing, and it's a wonderful place to be, to see the boats with the fishermen. You know, we still have a working fishing fleet, cocklers and fishermen. So it's an interest place. We have 1,000 years of history And it's all there for people to find out about and see. But when you come away from the old town, you find we have a wonderful shopping environment. We have lots and lots of individual shops, privately owned coffee shops. There's always somewhere for people to go, for people to meet. We've got an enormously thriving community centre that's run by the town council, where we have about 2,000 people a week go through the doors to various organisations, meetings and events. So, you know, it's the town has got a real buzz about it. And it's also, I feel, because I live right on top of the town almost, it's a safe place to be.
Right.
You know, I have no problems walking around in the evenings or anything like that, and I'm sure that other people feel the same.
No, absolutely right. Because people don't often think of Essex really as a seaside resort type county, do they? They think of it as sort of places like Basildon and you know, going into sort of central parts of Essex as birds of a feather and all that kind of thing. They don't really Whereas actually Colchester, which is in Essex, is one of the oldest cities in Britain, isn't it? Roman
absolutely.
City. And presumably there's quite a lot of Roman sort of heritage on that side of the coast as well.
Absolutely. The whole of Essex is, you know, we are such a diverse county in that, you know, come south to us and you've got the seaside, or you've got a huge coastline going right up to Suffolk. And then inland, you've got these historic towns like Colchester, Braintree, Chelmsford. You know, they don't sound like places that grab your attention, but they have a wealth of information and history for people to go and visit and see. So, and Lee is a little microcosm of that. And as I say, we've got 1,000 years of history and we're happy to share it with everyone.
No, of course. And I imagine you've got some great fish and chip shops being on the seaside itself.
Yes.
But have you got any particular delicacies that people in Lee-on-Sea specialise in?
You can't come to Lee and not eat cockles.
Really? And how's the best way to eat them? Because I think I've had them sort of cold with a bit of vinegar.
That's right. Well, that's the way most people eat them. Yeah, I mean, we have stalls down in the old town by the waterfront that you can go and buy your dish of cockles with the vinegar and pepper and that and eat like that. And that's where people come. You know, they come down. We've got some nice public houses down there. People come along on a Saturday or Sunday. And obviously this summer has been wonderful for the weather. They can sit by the waterside and watch the boats and watch now, a bit late now, but the Brent geese that we have come down in September, October.
Oh, very nice. And what about sort of the B&B setup? Is there lots of places to stay?
No, that's a little bit more difficult.
Okay.
You know, Lee is a residential town, basically.
Right.
It's grown up from the riverside, so the waterside, up to the town, and it's mainly residential. But obviously, we're very, very close to Southend, and there are places in Southend where people can stay, and it's a quick hop on the train, you know, 5 minutes down to Lee.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, you've got an airport at Southend now, haven't
you? Oh, yes, we've got an airport.
It doesn't sound like you're too keen on that.
No. I mean, you know, people have to get about, don't they?
They do.
So, you know, yes, we have an airport. It's a bit far away and it is a little bit of a bone of contention sometimes with the noise of the planes.
Yeah.
But,
well, I've seen it described as London Southend Airport, which
that's
is
what they call it, yeah.
Slightly bizarre because, I mean, if you're flying in from somewhere like Brazil and you think you're flying into London, you're going to get
a
bit
of a shock.
Well,
they call Luton London Luton, don't they?
Well, they do,
so,
yeah. They
yeah.
do. And Stansted, which is all a bit of a pain
exactly.
in the neck as well.
So it's all designed to confuse, I think. But,
indeed,
yeah.
absolutely. So what are you doing as to celebrate your award as being the happiest place in Britain?
Well, it's come at an absolutely wonderful time for us leading up to Christmas because tomorrow is our Lee Light.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And this is an event that takes place every year, the sort of last Friday in November, where we have our Christmas light switch on. We have a programme, a parade, which we have quite a lot of entries in, come through all the way through the shopping streets. And, you know, there are things on at the community centre for the children as well.
Okay.
And there are various events out along the parade. So that will start at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Very nice. And so have you got a local celebrity that you favour to put the lights on?
No. The lights don't... We don't have a switch on because the high street is quite a narrow area and it creates bottlenecks. So
okay.
what we have to act on police advice sort of thing, and their advice is... just have the
just
lights on.
Just don't have any
people...
fun at all. That's usually the police.
No. It'll be great fun. We get thousands of people and everybody has a great time.
All right, brilliant. Well, listen, congratulations. Well done. Councillor Carol Mulroney there from Leonsea, the happiest place in Britain. I can tell you about a few other happy places as well. Loughborough apparently gets a nod. Richmond upon Thames gets a nod. Macclesfield gets a nod. Edinburgh is in there. Farnham, Christchurch in Dorset. Monmouth in Wales, where our favourite MP David Davis is from. Leamington Spa gets some mention. Skipton in Yorkshire. And up in the northeast of England, funnily enough, it's not Sunderland that gets it. It's Hexham. As the happiest place in the northeast of England. So there you go. Lots more to come. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking about shoplifters, because apparently, if you shoplift anything less than about 50 quid's worth of stuff, there's a pretty good chance you will get away with it. And nobody will actually bother coming after you for it because the shops just can't be bothered. Isn't that extraordinary? 0344 499 1000. On the subject of the NHS and McDonald's, we'll keep taking your calls as well. My point says, I wish the opposite. McDonald's should learn from the NHS and give out free burgers. Well, they give out very cheap burgers from time to time, don't they? So I wouldn't be at all surprised if when the NHS does learn from McDonald's, they start to actually maybe make a little bit more money instead of wasting so much of it. They start to be a bit more user-friendly and treat us like the customers that we are, the paying customers that we are, because after all, we are paying through the nose an awful lot of money, despite what Dr. Irvin said earlier in this particular show on this particular hour, that actually we are putting less money in than most other countries in the Western world. It can't be that true, can it?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So picture the scene, right? You're sitting there having a nice glass of wine, a candlelit dinner, and your Alexa starts to analyse the conversation that you're having with your other half. Now, you might be having an argument. You might be having a talk about going on holiday together. You might be having an argument about who is going to feed the dog or who's going to take the kids at the weekend or whatever it is. Alexa is going to suddenly start analysing the words that you're saying and the words that you're getting back in the response, and is going to tell you whether or not you can actually break up your relationship because of what you're saying and how you're saying it. Let's talk to Joe Hemmings now, who's a psychologist and dating coach. Because this sounds horrendous to me, Joe. Very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Yeah, it sounds equally horrendous to me, Mike. the problem is, yes, you know, it can listen to what you say and how you say it and give a view, but it doesn't know why you're saying it. It doesn't know what kind of mood you're in, what happened, what triggered that argument, whether it's a one-off. I mean, you know, it's a pretty desperate place we're in if we're relying on, you know, a little machine like Alexa sort of to tell us whether our relationship is going to last or not.
And well, yeah. Well, you'd like to think, would you not, that judging by the responses you're getting from the person sitting opposite you, you'd have a rough idea of how it's going.
Indeed. And if you got to a place where you're having a lot of arguments and perhaps you needed some counselling, some human intervention who would understand psychologically where you were coming from and what was going on, that might be one thing. But, you know, if Alexa started telling me that my relationship, you know, was kind of all but over because I was mid-argument, I'm afraid I'd probably throw Alexa against the wall.
Yeah, well, don't do that, because I did that with my router once, and I had to get a new one. It took me ages to get it from Vodafone. But anyway, what about also, if they're collecting this kind of data anyway, that's also something to be slightly concerned about, isn't it? Because what effectively it means, I mean, we had this conversation a few weeks ago with somebody else, I think, on the air, that, you know, if you're not careful, you don't switch off all your microphones on your phone. Basically, you know, Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram and various other, Google, I think, are all collecting the things that you're saying, and they're throwing adverts at you based on what you're talking about, which is really quite scary, isn't it?
It's really scary. I mean, you have to know on your phone how to switch it off. I mean, you know, it happened to me a few weeks ago.
Because
I just think it was probably a conspiracy theory. You know, it's ridiculous. They're not listening out for us. But I called out to somebody in the street that passed me. And then the next thing I knew, I had, had tweeted something a few minutes later.
Oh, really?
Either that's a massive coincidence, or it heard me and realized I was interested in whatever he was saying. So I kind of begin to think they are, you know, there is effectively, they are listening. Certainly we know online, you go onto something immediately, you know, that banner comes up sort of displaying it to you because you didn't buy it, or even if you did buy it, there it is.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of listening and going in, and once it gets to your relationship, I mean, it's like a nosy Parker.
Well, exactly. Well, it's like some annoying, friend that follows you around just making remarks at you every time you say anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just a desperate state of affairs. And I'd really like not to see it happen.
Well, indeed. Yeah. And the other thing, as it was pointed out to me just a few moments ago, what if you're, you know, if it's collecting data on you personally and listening to everything that's being said in the house, what if you're watching EastEnders or something and, you know, some storyline comes up? Does it know that that's not you or not?
Well, it's supposed to have voice recognition, so I guess it's supposed to think it's not you.
Mm.
But the thing is, it's so unsophisticated at the present time, and I'd be terrified if it ever got sophisticated enough to say, you know, do a job better than I do with counselling clients, but
right.
It's possible. It's just very unsophisticated, so it's going to be clumsy and cluggy, whatever it says, and intrusive, and probably wrong.
Yeah, well, yeah. Right. And I mean, you know, if you're going to take all the fun out of dating somebody and going out with somebody by kind of basically trying to predict how it's all going to work out, this kind of ruins the whole point of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I presume you've got to have quite a few arguments to build up some sort of picture of you before it says it, because otherwise you're just having some silly row about something and decides your relationship isn't worth continuing, even though you've been, you know, blissfully happy for the last, say, 6 months.
Yeah, well, indeed. And what about
a lot of busted up relationships knocking around.
And what about this other business about what we are likely to be doing in the future, that by 2025, our genetic code will somehow make it possible to predict what sort of sexual chemistry we're going to have with each other?
Well, yeah, what I call swabbing for love. We thought swiping for love was bad enough. I mean, look, it's kind of possible. Actually, there is no real scientific basis for pheromones. It's based on pheromones, a lot of this, and smell. There's no scientific evidence for pheromones, whatever anybody says. There are in mice, but nothing's been proven in humans. Yeah, compatibility, lifestyle matches, blah, blah. Yeah, we kind of understand that. But yeah, I'm sure DNA could kind of point us in the right direction. It might help, but it's departing further and further away to make your romance in a lab and give you, yes, D463 is compatible with you.
Yeah.
It's taking it so far from romance and so far from that kind of feeling you get when you meet someone face-to-face, let alone on a dating app, which, as I said, seemed bad enough before. It's just, again, it's a horrible thing.
Yeah.
And I might be old-fashioned, but I don't want to meet some set of numbers via a DNA testing kit that they think I will fancy.
But isn't that the way things are going as well, though? Because we now have sort of a generation or two of people who expect everything to be instant, who expect everything to be done when they want it to be done, you know, so including presumably their love life. Because the whole point, surely, of romance is it's not very scientific. But if you try and make it scientific and make it into a kind of a quest, because now's the night I've decided, you know, I'm 27, I've decided it's time to meet somebody and get married. I mean, I know people that used to do that in the old days, but now you can actually do it.
Well, no, you can. And the truth is, there is some science to, not much dating, but to attraction.
There's
definitely science there. Oh, yeah. And so what people might do is use it the other way around and say, well, I really like this guy, this girl. We're getting on very well. Let's do the DNA in reverse. Let's see if we're actually compatible. Now, if it turns out you're not compatible via DNA, or something called major histocompatibility complex, MHC, then you might think, oh, I was going so well, but now scientifically I've been told that
well,
I'm not suitable for it.
Just by using those very words, which I'd like you to repeat for the purposes of killing off any kind of romantic notions I might have had, you know, that's precisely what is wrong, isn't it?
Yes, that word is major histocompatibility complex, even I can't say it.
Yeah.
It regulates our immune system. It's thought to unconsciously influence our mate choice. That's
okay.
What it is. And again, it works in mice. But you know, not they don't have a particularly exciting romantic life, mice, as far as I know. Don't know if we know whether it works in humans yet. Perhaps it does, but again, it's used as an option, as a bit of even a fun option, or as a really good option, perhaps for in terms of fertility or having babies that are healthy. That's one thing, but you know, stripping back romance, stripping back what I call proper chemistry, which is just seeing someone and thinking, or hearing them and thinking, that's my type.
Mm.
And to be told actually they're not in a science lab would be, quite a miserable place to be.
Well, indeed. Because I was going to say, I mean, obviously I bow to your superior knowledge of these matters. However, you know, the point of looking across a crowded room at somebody and seeing somebody that you don't feel anything for, and then seeing somebody next to them who you absolutely just can't wait to go out with, for no apparent reason that you can think of, surely there's no science in that at all, is there?
There is a science in lust, yeah. I mean, you can kind of see certain things happen in your brain and when you fancy someone. I mean, there's science behind it, but not a kind of DNA matching type science.
Oh, okay.
When your brain lights up when you fancy someone, and you, that's why we get, you know, flutters in our tummies, or we feel a bit sort of jittery, or get a bit pink in the cheeks, get a bit breathless, all those things. Something is happening. Adrenaline, basically. Is,
yeah, I'm sorry. I have no idea what you're talking about. It hasn't happened to me for such a long time, Joe, that I've forgotten what it's
okay.
like.
Okay, well, when it happens again, you'll recognise it. But that's a hormonal thing, and that is not to do with anything to do with your DNA, or, I'm not going to say that phrase again, NHC.
No.
That is simply hormones reacting to you seeing somebody. So there's science there, but not this kind of science.
Okay. And finally, I suppose, it won't be a million miles away from then using DNA to match yourself up in terms of your progeny and what sort of success you're going to have having children, if that's what you want to have, and how successful your children will be in life and what they might wish to not carry as a genetic disease and all of those things. I mean, we are going to be moving into what the Daily Mail would call Frankenstein medicine, aren't we?
Well, we are. I mean, you know, in America, it's still pretty, it's pretty commonplace to do that. They have far more genetics matching tests in terms of the health of their babies than we do in the UK. I mean, they go through a barrage of it as a regular thing. So that is happening, and sometimes that is a good thing to predict the health of a child. Sometimes it's very worrying for couples because just about everything gets tested, so it gives you something else to be anxious about. You know, that could be useful, of course, with anyone with, you know, genetic preconditions. I get that, but when we get to love and romance, No.
No, quite right too. Absolutely. Joe, thanks very much indeed. Joe Hemmings there, psychologist and dating coach, telling us how there is quite a lot of science involved in the process of becoming attracted to somebody. But do we really want something like Alexa convincing us or telling us precisely whether we are going to have a successful relationship with somebody or not? Richard says, my Alexa sits next to the Mac where I watch TMTV. I now know why my Facebook ads are full of divorce lawyers and hitmen. Well, that's very funny and very interesting indeed.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
And pour me something tall and strong. Make it a hurricane before I go insane. It's only 12:30, but I don't care. It's 5:00 somewhere.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham, 0344 499 1000. Lunch is fast approaching, I have to say. I might have some mead for a drink at lunchtime rather than the usual glass of beer or perhaps a glass of wine. We're going to talk to Luke Hutchinson now, director and beekeeper at the Northumberland Honey Company, which is in a very beautiful part of the world, not far from Hexham, which was, of course, voted the nicest place in the northeast of England over Sunderland, believe it or not. Luke, a very good morning. Good afternoon to you, I should say.
Yeah, good afternoon. Now
you all know a lot about Vikings coming from that part of the world, because the Vikings all landed over that way, didn't they? And came down to Hull and all the rest of it. I've been to the Norvik Viking Centre. Tell us about mead, because apparently Game of Thrones has become so popular that mead is drunk in that show, and loads of people are now drinking mead, I'm told.
Yeah, absolutely. Game of Thrones has done the mead industry a world of good, really, in terms of just getting the name of mead out there.
Right.
A lot of people that come to us and, you know, say, you know, they've either had mead before, we ask them about their experience of mead, and often it's been quite a sweet, syrupy, sickly experience. But a lot of mead makers are now making mead in a really nice, approachable way,
right,
sort of even dry.
So we'll be getting sort of what I would have termed sort of yuppie mead or millennial mead or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. The millennials are coming of age and starting to be able to drink, and they're kind of looking for something a bit different, perhaps,
yeah,
to what the parents, you know, opposite to what the parents used to drink, even.
Mm.
So our sort of new alcoholic drink that's available to the masses is becoming mead, and it's becoming more popular.
Okay.
We're getting a lot more meaderies.
And do you drink it sort of like beer in the sense of that kind of amount, like a half pint or a pint, something like that?
Well, do you know, the beauty with mead is that mead is any honey alcohol, so you can make that from any percentage you like, all the way up to distilling it. So it can be like a mead, it can be like a cider, it can be like a wine, or even like a champagne, like the sparkling meads that we do.
Okay.
So it's really a blank canvas, and that's kind of what is creating such a buzz, if you pardon the pun.
Yes. No, absolutely. And how alcoholic is it by sort of percentage of volume?
Well, ours is 12%, so it's on par with your sparkling wines and champagne, because that's the method that we do it in. But equally, there's some really good meads down at a low alcohol percentage, sort of 4 or 5%, all the way up to 17, 18%. And there's even a couple of producers distilling, so you can have that as you would do a spirit.
Okay, because, I mean, traditionally, I would always see, you'd see bottles of mead in kind of farm shops, maybe, or if you went to visit a castle, they'd have it there, you know, that kind of thing. You'd probably buy it, I don't know, at the Tower of London shop. Yeah. I mean, how easily available is it sort of retail-wise?
Quite difficult, actually, and especially as a new mead producer, it's difficult getting it across to retailers that people are actually after it. So it's kind of, it's becoming more widely available, but it's actually just getting it across to retailers that it's a very good thing to stock, because traditionally, and people will be listening to this now, saying, oh, I've got a bottle of mead and it sat on the shelf, I got halfway down it and don't want to touch it anymore because it was quite an unpleasant experience.
Oh, really?
But actually, there's a lot of more meads that are very approachable, very friendly, as it were, and easy to drink. And they are meads that aren't sitting on the shelves now, and they are being drunk by the masses, really.
Yeah. I've got a tweet here now from somebody called Rob, who's just sent me a picture, which he says it's coming from English Heritage, and it's an advert for mead. And there's a glass, a sort of champagne flute, and then there's a tumbler of it as well. It looks kind of orangey-coloured.
Yeah.
Is that always that colour?
It can be any colour. Like, it depends very much on the honey. So if you imagine wine, different grapes give you different wines. So different honey will give you a different colour to the mead. You can even... honestly, it's such a blank canvas in terms of how you can make mead. This is also kind of one of the things that's difficult to get across to the general public, that mead can take many, many forms.
Okay.
So you can drink it like a Viking, really strong, syrupy, 18% alcohol, or you can have it, you know, lighter and more approachable.
Mm. And, I mean, as far as the process goes itself, it's fermented rather than distilled, right? So it's not it's not a spirit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is the odd mead available that is distilled, so there is that to mention, but generally it's fermented honey. So we're not using grapes, we're fermenting honey and spring water, and it's the sugar that's in the honey that is the base that gives you the alcohol. The yeast eats the sugars in the honey.
Uh-huh.
So that's why when you actually ferment these, you'd think it was sweet, but actually imagine honey with all the sweetness removed, and that's effectively what you get left with in some of these meads. It's sort of the floral aspects of honey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever actually had it, but I mean, I've got some people suggesting you can drink it cold, but you can also mull it as well. Do you have it warm?
Exactly, this is the great thing about mead. There's no hard and fast rules. So you can warm it up, you can put spices with it, you can get spiced meads. What we do, it's very much an expression of the honey because we're beekeepers. So all of our mead is produced by our own honey. So we're effectively like a vineyard, but without grapes.
Okay.
So there's no hard and fast rules with it, but ours is more of an expression of the honey.
And so, I mean, do you sell it in a shop there? Do you sell it online?
Yeah, we sell it online. So we're Northumberland Honey, and that's easily searchable. And we sell it directly, but also we do have various shops up and down the country, so places like Tea Bay Services and Gloucester Services, which are sort of higher-end farm shop services.
Right.
And a lot of, you know, it's becoming more widely available as we as the mead industry grows.
And how much per bottle would you say it costs?
Well, ours is probably at the higher end, at sort of £35 to £30, because we're talking about 2 years to make a bottle, actually. So
two
it's a
years?
Long time. Yeah, exactly. So time as well is a crucial ingredient with mead. So aging mead is very, it rounds things off and makes things a lot more more approachable again, and it brings out a lot of the floral aromas of the honey. But equally, you can get it all the way down to sort of, you know, for a few pounds for a very low alcohol mead. So it depends on the alcohol percentage.
Okay. So, I mean, would it be something that, say, for example, if you've got a bottle of it, a bit like wine for dinner, you would drink the whole bottle? I mean,
exactly. If you're talking 12%, then yes, that's perfectly acceptable. You know, we encourage responsible drinking,
course.
So ideally to share. But there's a lot of mead.
You don't want to go on some sort of Viking rampage after drinking too much mead,
exactly.
Do you?
Exactly. You would probably need a drinking horn for that.
Yeah, absolutely right. So how did you get into this business, Luke? Were you always into beekeeping or what?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm a beekeeper, effectively. My wife, she is a scientist by extraction, so she's a PhD.
Okay.
And effectively, when you get a beekeeper with honey and a scientist together, effectively you get sparkling mead, which is what we do.
Very nice.
So the thing that makes us unique is we are the only ones that are producing a champagne method mead in the UK, and there's actually only another producer over in the States in San Francisco, so we're quite rare beasts, really.
Okay, and is the consistency of your sparkling mead, is it like a sparkling wine, or is it a bit thicker?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like sparkling wine because we're not adding tannins to it, so it's nice and gentle. And also, all of the sugars are fermented out of it, so it's light, it's delicate, and actually, a lot of people would say it's very much like a sparkling wine or a champagne.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating stuff. Luke, thank you for joining us, and thank you for giving us that little education on mead, director and beekeeper at Northumberland Honey Company. But according to all of those people who know, English Heritage, which is the country's largest retailer of the drink, apparently said that sales of mead have risen by an average of 10% year on year for the past 3 years. Apparently, there's a mead-themed cocktail bar in Birmingham, where apparently people go to try all kinds of different sorts of mead. Some pagans go there for occasionally, looking for a selection for their weddings. How remarkable, isn't it, what goes on in this country?
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.